Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care. Welcome back to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I'm Kim. And I'm missing Kara. Kara's just getting back from her amazing trip in Italy, and I can't wait to hear all about it. So we're actually bringing you a special episode this week. Our friends over at The Murder Diaries, Natalie and Paige, invited us over for a conversation on ethics and true crime from our point of views both as survivors and as podcasters in the true crime genre. So enjoy this bonus episode today, and we'll be back with our normally scheduled episodes again next week. In the meantime, you can always catch us on patreon.com/sgtc. And now, here's the Murder Diaries conversation with Survivor's Guide to True Crime.
Today on the Murder Diaries, we're doing something a little different. We're speaking about ethics and advocacy in true crime with two people we've learned a lot from. Our friends from Survivor's Guide to True Crime, Kara Robinson-Chamberlain and Kimberly Corbin.
We are here with two incredible survivors, Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson-Chamberlain. Thank you both so much for being here today. Just for the recording, we want to say that obviously we would love to like invite you both to tell whatever you're comfortable with about your stories, just for context of, you know, who you are and kind of where Survivor's Guide came from, of course, which comes from your background. But we want to make sure, obviously, like if you don't feel safe doing so today, you know, of course, please, we know that you do it a lot and we don't want to be one of those places that makes you relive it too, but we know it's a big part of who you are. So if you don't mind, go ahead and start by introducing yourselves.
Sure. Well, I want to preface this by saying that we are going to discuss sexual violence and kidnapping. I'll let Kara do her own trigger and content warning, but if you are in a place where you don't feel like you can consume this kind of content, please take a break, fast forward, whatever you need to do. We always include resources and links on our websites, which I'm sure you'll all do as well in show notes, but please take care of yourself and listen at your own speed. Kara, you want to go ahead?
Absolutely. So my name is Kara Robinson-Chamberlain. And the short version, I guess the elevator pitch of who I am and how I came to be where I am today is when I was 15 years old in 2002, I was kidnapped from my best friend's front yard by a stranger. I later came to find out that person was a serial killer after I escaped from him. I was held captive for 18 hours by him, sexually assaulted multiple times, and was ultimately able to escape while he was sleeping. And went to law enforcement, gave them information that led to his identification. About 2 days later, after a police chase, he committed suicide. He was about a month and a half later linked to 3 previously unsolved homicides in Virginia in 1996-97. That's when I found out I escaped a serial killer, went on to form relationships in law enforcement, work in law enforcement up until the birth of my children, working as a school resource officer and then an investigator investigating child abuse and sexual assault cases, and ultimately a victim's advocate. Did that up until the birth of my children, like I said, and took a break for a little while for raising children and returned to advocacy work when I met Elizabeth Smart and sit down with some other survivors and what it looks like to feel seen and heard. And that ultimately changed the course of my life and began to form relationships with other survivors like Kim and realized that we needed some different perspectives on not only this true crime industry, but what it means to be a survivor. And if sharing my story was something that could help other people in their healing process and feeling seen, and if it was something that could make a change in the ethics of the true crime genre, then that absolutely was something that I would do. And so that's how I came to be here.
So I was a 20-year-old college student at the University of Northern Colorado in Greeley, and a stranger broke into my college area apartment, held me captive for 2 hours, and sexually assaulted me. I reported immediately because I knew that that was a very black and white crime that had been committed. So I never had to deal with that shame or stigma that we so often know victims go through. He was caught. He was actually picking out his next victim at a neighboring apartment complex. He was prosecuted. And so over the course of 16 months from the time that this happened to when he was sentenced, my life was completely changed. And I decided near the end of that jury trial
that if all of the things that I had been going through could help one other person not have to experience what I did, then it would be worth it. And so I released my name to the media. I started taking an active role in talking out about this because at 2006, 2007, I'm trying to do math in my head. That's not something I want to do on a Friday afternoon. But as I was seeing that there was no one like me or the stories that I could go to and find that kind of strength, I knew that that was maybe something that other people would be looking to, because as I started disclosing what happened to me, so many other people started coming forward and I realized this is a much bigger issue than I ever realized. So I had started speaking out, have been doing that now for 16 years and have had some incredible opportunities, not just to elevate a platform that talks about sexual violence, but to connect with fellow survivors. Like Kara said, we met on TikTok when our advocacy efforts changed from in-person to online and just hit it off right away. So this was something that was in the works for a very long time. We needed to find the right space and have the right people, I think, believe in us to give us just that little bit of extra push. But what Kara and I get to do with Survivor's Guide to True Crime is create this space that we already have been a part of, and we get to share it with the world to let them know that, yes, this is just the two of us having a conversation, usually with one, maybe two guests, but you can create that kind of community and that safe place in your own lives too. Here are some of the tips and the tricks and the ways that you can start to feel comfortable in your own skin, to find that strength, to have your voice, and to make those connections, because they really can alter your entire life.
So you're not only creating a community for other survivors, but you're showcasing how to be in the driver's seat of telling their own story.
Oh, absolutely. So my whole thing, when I go back and look at even my very first on-camera interview, I say it then and I've continued to say it even today. I don't care if you remember my name or my face. I want you to remember my story. And what Kara and I try to do with each episode is give you, the listener, the tools to do what you need to do in your own life to feel as healed and complete as possible. It's not what's worked best for us. It's going to be different for everyone. It's going to be different even at different stages in your life. But we want you to feel that you are in control of that healing, that you have autonomy and a voice over your story.
That's really lovely. Kimberly, you were just saying there is something to learn from the stories that survivors are telling themselves, which goes towards what I learned big time. And I'm so embarrassed, but I'm here to tell our listeners that I learned, don't tell the survivor's story without their permission or let them tell it. And as a privileged non-survivor, it was more of this feeling like, oh, well, if they're telling it and they're on the circuit, that's awesome. They want to tell it. They've got, you know, whatever education is coming from it. I'm going to, you know, do that, you know, kind of in solidarity with them. But you don't have that permission, you're not. And I can't believe at the age that I was that I learned that. It seems like it makes so much sense, but yeah, it was something I didn't know.
Yeah, it seems so simple and it seems like such a moment where you're like, duh, of course.
Yeah.
But if no one says it to you, if you haven't spoken to someone mm-hmm. who, like Kim, like myself, like Sarah, who opens up social media and sees their story being told and they weren't tagged, or even if you were tagged, and it's a little bit like a game of telephone where there's always going to be minor things that aren't quite right when you're not telling your own story, it just feels like the most personal thing to you, the most personal thing in your life, it's being taken and used by someone else. And it feels at best icky, and at worst, it feels like exploitation. And I think a lot of people don't take that into consideration when they're telling these stories without the permission or cooperation. And at the end of the day, you don't need permission, but it's a courtesy.
It's a best practice. It's treating those victims as whole people with respect. But let's also take a minute to recognize that you are doing that with a good intent, right? You are wanting to elevate those stories. You're wanting to tell them. That's a good thing. Now, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't have consent. Like, all of the things that we're talking about should be put into play. There's a difference in the type of creator that Kara and I talk about and address constantly, because you have the ones that are trying to get the word out and spread this awareness, whether it's about child abuse or trafficking or domestic violence or sex assault, whatever it might be, you have good intent. Mm-hmm. But then you have the content creators who are simply there for what we call trauma porn. They want the clicks. They want the likes. Case in point, I was on TikTok yesterday, taking two or three minutes to scroll along, just sort of zone out. And the first thing that comes up is a live feed of a creator, and she's got a green screen behind her. She is retelling a story that is very, very personal to myself and my husband. It's not my story, though, but we know the ins and outs of it in ways that other people don't. And I text Kara right away. I was like, look at this, because she is saying, I'm going to play this audio if we get to 40,000 likes. Keep hitting that like thing. And then continuously talking about, you know, here's what so-and-so said. The stuff that she is repurposing and regurgitating very clearly for clicks, clout, followers is old information and it's incorrect information. And they don't care because the people that are in those comments consuming are feeding off of each other. And that is the sort of true crime genre following, if you will, that we want to educate. But you also have to want to be educated on it. If you're in it strictly for entertainment and you want to turn it off and not make a difference, we're probably not going to reach you, but you're also probably not our audience.
Yeah. And we've actually learned a lot from you guys and Sarah. For full transparency, we actually have covered two survivors' cases in the past. But the moment we learned how inappropriate that was, how we were further victimizing the victim, we took it down and we made a hard line in the sand for what our ethics are as true crime content creators. And that is, we will not ever cover a survivor's case unless they choose to use our platform and share it with their own voice. And that's actually something that we've done a few times now with family members for victims that still haven't had justice. We always tell them, like, we've built this platform, but it is at your disposal. Please come on and tell your story how you want it to be told. If you don't want to tell it, that's your right and we won't touch it. And so, like, you guys are making a difference in just how we approach things. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you.
And I commend you on that because I know that is a hard line to draw. And I know in this genre of true crime, it feels like it is just oversaturated. And I know a lot of people fall victim right now to just needing to get their information out there. And I know it's compelling and I know it's difficult. And so I just commend you for one, being willing to learn and change and grow, but also being willing to set those standards and stick to them because I know it's hard.
I appreciate that because it is embarrassing to admit that we posted them, but I think it just shows...
That's the true measure of an apology. That's the true measure of growth.
Yeah, I think it shows how much we've grown. And I appreciate, like, you know, that we're a partnership that, you know, Paige and I both agree on these things. And so
that's so important too. You have to have that camaraderie. And especially when I'm finding you have more than one host with a podcast, the most important thing that people are there for is your friendship and that mutual respect. And, you know, Kara and I can disagree on different things, but at the end of the day, none of that matters because we are together in this. She's stuck with us. Our husbands are stuck with us. Let's be real.
Yeah, we're all stuck together. Sorry. Codependent trauma bonds.
Enjoy.
I love that. You know, and it's not to trivialize the idea of being a survivor, but I think of just some of the medical conditions, for example, that I have that, like, sometimes, you know, a family member or somebody might share to somebody without me even knowing.
Yeah.
And that wasn't to a wide audience of a whole true crime podcast. That's like from one person to one person. And that can be embarrassing enough. So when I really sit and, like, reflect on it, it just was like, pff, like, major light bulbs.
Yeah. You make a really good point that I think will probably resonate with more of your listeners than being the victim of a high profile crime. Your story and the things that happen to you that you don't have control over are yours. And when someone else begins talking about that, it doesn't have to be a sex assault or something. How about a breakup? Someone's gossiping about it. It feels like you lose control and it's a little bit dehumanizing. That spotlight effect and feeling like everyone is staring at you or knows something about you that you can't control, that narrative doesn't feel good. When it's on a much larger scale like this that Kara and I are talking about, when it is some kind of victimization that altered our very brain chemistry and you have people that are profiting off of that and making it into clickbait. It is one of the most dehumanizing feelings, and it also re-victimizes us over and over again. I think the biggest one that I've had, at least in recent memory, I have a 911 call that I made that morning, and I shared it to YouTube originally in 2016 as a part of my keynote presentation so that I could access that. And then through a series of day-long tweets for the 10th anniversary, I used it as a training tool. Under that, I have trigger warnings, resources, the rest of the story, ways to contact, all of the things that we eat, sleep, live, breathe along with it. And now I open up TikTok and I will see a video of someone playing Roblox with my screams as the audio behind it. They don't want to take it down. They aren't interested in that. They'll have people narrating. It'll be my video that I've created with my screaming that I was raped to dispatchers. And somebody's the green screened in the front of it just going, and it's not helpful. It's not resources. They're not tagging. They're not asking permission. And that is one platform that I never wanted that shared on. And I wanted it in a space that it could be used for education. But it's in the public domain and I don't get to control it.
I'm sorry that happened. Sorry just feels like so little for you having to go through that. It's awful.
Yeah, thanks.
The idea of something so personal, one of the worst, if not the worst moments of your life being, and I'll use the word hijacked like that, It's unfathomable. And it brings me to your TED Talk, where I can only describe that TED Talk as a gut check, even more. And for our listeners that haven't seen it, we'll link that in the show notes with your permission as well.
Of course, thank you.
Your story, as explained and what I took from the TED Talk, was hijacked from this idea of like the political side of things, not something that you might guess or assume would hijack a survivor's story without their consent or just take it on their own. And it seems like that's what you talk about in your TED Talk that happened to you. Can you talk a little bit about your experience sort of working on the political side of things and how that happened? Because it seems like it was used for political gain. Your story was used for political gain that didn't necessarily have a ton to do with you other than what you were interested in trying to advocate for. And it just kind of came in and swept away.
Let me start by, okay, let's discuss politics now. All right. I was not super into politics, especially growing up. I wasn't even in college. It was not something that was of interest to me, and I didn't think it impacted me erroneously. I will say politics have something to do with everyone. It is something that you should keep an eye on and be a watchdog for, but you don't necessarily have to get involved in the nitty-gritty if your space is too cluttered to take that on. I chose many years after my assault to begin concealed carrying. I was a student at the same college in grad school. And for my own personal protection, for a multitude of reasons, I decided to take courses to train, use safety methods, and I was doing all of those things before I ever got my concealed carry permit. That story and a bill that was being heard in Colorado, specifically surrounding concealed carry on campuses, I went down and testified for because it directly impacted me and my life. It just grabbed all of these headlines out of nowhere. And I didn't expect it to make the impact that it had because I've testified on like bond legislation and different things for victims' rights before. But this is my first foray into the world of polarizing Second Amendment politics. The NRA got a hold of that story. And when they first brought me in, I saw a world of people who had not been exposed to victim advocacy, to trauma, to victim representation, and I knew that I had a lot of work to do. So I approached this thinking, this is one small piece of my survivor story, but if it gets other people who otherwise wouldn't hear it to listen and to learn, that's great. And so I don't even know how I best want to say this, but I was pretty naive. I jumped in with both feet and was so excited to be working on a national scale where I felt like I was really impacting victims. And I was. The speeches that I would give at these different places, I would have people lined up, and I'm not kidding, some these lines after speeches were 2 and 3 hours long of victims who would come up and disclose what happened to them. Those are the impacts that were important to me. And it wasn't until I realized that my name and my face, the things that I didn't care if people remembered, were being used alongside my story that I no longer had control over. And I can clearly remember the moment where you talk about drawing a line in the sand. I was in Washington, D.C., and I was asked to come into this filming studio because they were putting together a campaign of ads to purchase and to put out that had to do with the 2016 election. And I went and they had this script already written for me. It is a minute-long segment that they were going to cut down to 30 seconds, depending on where they would be showing that commercial. I'm fairly new, but I'm pretty media savvy at the same time. I worked as a public information officer, and I had been doing media stuff for long enough that I'm like, okay, some of this isn't right. Like my actual story, some pieces aren't right. And at the end, it had me endorsing a political candidate who shall go unnamed. And I said, absolutely not. Never once have I said that I want to endorse this candidate. And frankly, I don't. You will not get me to say that. And so they let me still record the ad because it was more about, hey, the opposition, I'm not a fan of. If you had to ask me, I was not going to vote for the candidate that they threw all of their money behind and went into debt for, but they used it as if I was. And I didn't understand that until the following year when this girl comes up to me, and I talk about this in the TED Talk where she was asked to ghostwrite my story. She sees nothing wrong with it. And frankly, I don't blame her. She's doing her job. She's at an after party, half in the bag, telling me how impactful my story was that she rewrote, got wrong. I had no idea that this went out, but apparently it was the largest direct fundraising campaign that they had all year. And it was talking about my rape that I didn't write, but they wrote it as if I did. And that is not something that happens in a silo by itself. This is something that happens not just on one side of the aisle. Please do not mistake me for saying that one side is good and bad. It's not the case. Both sides do this constantly. And you have to make sure that if you are sharing your story in that way, you maintain that control and that autonomy over it. But frankly, they're going to take it and use it no matter what. So having survivor and victim voices represented in local legislation is incredibly important, but we need to be speaking up as people who are not directly impacted on behalf of them. I shouldn't have to go down and testify at the Capitol for a bill that was being heard 2 days ago on judges that should be better represented and more informed on domestic violence for family court cases. But if survivors and victims aren't doing it, who will?
Or who has the perspective besides survivors and victims?
Right.
Sounds like from your story too, just going back a little bit, that not only was your story hijacked, but almost your likeness in many ways as well, trying to paint you as promoting one thing. That's a whole mess.
Oh, totally. And I had a really hard time because parts of it, yes, I'm actively engaged in, I'm enjoying it. Kara and I were just talking about this. I got to film a web series that was 6 episodes long with Sig Sauer in New Hampshire back in, I want to say 2017. It was awesome. I absolutely loved it because we did situational awareness training. I got more training during that time filming that series than most of our law enforcement officers do. I would feel completely comfortable going in and clearing out a house just with the information and the training that I got during that time. Now, Kara can attest to this as well. When we talk about these things, it can be really polarizing, but for us, it's just part of our everyday life. Take something like that, and then I hear afterwards, we're going to use this, but we're going to use it to sell our insurance now. That wasn't in my contract. That wasn't something that I agreed to, and I drew that hard line in the sand, and it was ugly. It was not pretty. Kara, chime in, because I feel like I'm getting off the rails.
Well, I'm glad you're asking Kara to chime in, because I am curious. I know Kara has had a documentary, and I know that she's had a movie based on her experience and her survival. And you were involved in both productions, but I am curious if you've experienced somewhat of what Kimberly's talking about, of your story being hijacked from you and what that felt like as, you know, yourself hearing someone else tell your story.
Yeah, absolutely. It happens, I want to say daily. It's probably not that frequently, but it feels like it's daily that I will get someone who will send me a photo or a screen grab. Oh, I opened up YouTube and this person covered your case, or I'm watching you on TV. I think the most recent one is, I was just telling Kim about this a few days ago, where I got a message from someone and they were like, oh, I see you on this show. And they told me the name of the show. And I was like, I never did that show. And they were like, but you're on it. And I'm like, right. They used that and they used other content that I created with, I guess, their umbrella, like their parent network. And they had repurposed it for a whole new show. So, you know, when we do interviews and we sign contracts with media companies, they own that content and then they can do whatever they want with it, which, you know, that's a whole different discussion. But I had previously to doing the movie and the documentary, I had done several interviews and media related things where I had shared my story in a public manner. And I was never really happy with them. I simply was doing keynotes, doing appearances, doing interviews because I was asked and it was easy for me to do. I didn't really have a purpose. I was just like, sure, I'll do it. And so that led to me taking things without much forethought. And it led to situations in which cameras would cut and the person who was interviewing me would look at me and say, okay, now, can you go back and tell this part again, but could you inject a little more emotion into it? Because I'm very straightforward. There's not a lot of emotion when I tell my story because I was dissociated. I don't actually have emotions encoded in those memories. I had many experiences like that. And when I decided to kind of get back into this advocacy world, this world of sharing my story publicly and keynotes and things like that, I realized that I had to tell my story in a way that I was proud of, something that I could hold up and show people and say, this is who I am. If you want to know my story, this is where you look. And I turned to the only person that I trusted at that time, and that was Elizabeth Smart. I reached out to her. She had become a friend at that point. And I said, this is what I want to do. I want to do a documentary. And who do you recommend? So she pointed me towards the production company that she worked with for her movie and her documentary. And that's Marwar Junction. And they said, if this is something you want to do, absolutely. You'll be an executive producer. The documentary was done first. I was involved from beginning to end. So starting with the pitch and then the production, everything from beginning to end. And then about a year later, I had someone reach out who said that they wrote for Lifetime. They wanted to write and pitch to Lifetime. And so I went back to my production company. I said, I got this request and what are your thoughts? They said, do you want to do a movie? And I said, I would consider it. It was never something that was kind of a goal or a dream for me, but I trust you guys to do it correctly. And I've seen the one that you did for Elizabeth. And they said, okay, well, let's take it and you'll be involved every step of the way yet again. And so that was kind of how those two projects came about. And now I can genuinely say I can stand behind those projects and I can hold them up and say, I am proud of these because I was involved. And there were times in the documentary and the movie where things would be kind of going in a way that I wasn't comfortable with. So specifically, with the movie more so, there was one part where they were trying to steer the dialogue and the end one direction. And I kind of kicked rocks for about 24 hours and was like, I hate this. I don't like it. And I was like, I don't know what to do. And then it was kind of like, you have control over this. So I went to the production company. I said, hey, I don't like this. And they're like, okay, no problem. We'll change it. Even though I knew that was the case, I was surprised because all of my experience previously was that my story wasn't my own. I had an author when I was 17 who wrote a book about my captor, and I didn't want her to include my information. She included my name. She got the incident report. So my entire life of having this story that's compelling has been my story being told by other people to some degree. So feeling like I had a say and feeling like I was heard was very off-putting for me in a lot of ways. And ultimately, I realized how much I had been sort of abused in sharing my story previously. And it became a big impetus for wanting to change and wanting to educate other people.
Kara, one of the things that I remember too from when they were going through the documentary
that was so illustrative of what it looks like to do it the right way is one of the gals who was on set sending you a picture saying that, "I know your shirt was white, but we can't use white on screen because it looks bad on the camera. So are you okay with us switching it?" And it seems so small, but for us, the things that are seared into our memories are big deals.
Same for the movie. They did the same thing for the movie with, you know, the actress that played me, Katie. If you notice the clothes that she's wearing when she runs out of the apartment, if you've seen my story, you've seen the photo of me in the police department or me at the hospital, and the clothes look very different. And so they're texting me through the whole process. They're like, "Hey, we can't use that because it has a logo. We have to license it." Or I remember getting photos one day and it's like the whole cast and crew standing next to the car and they have like a plastic container sitting there and they're like, "How do we get this in here?" And so how did you fit in this? And, you know, so I'm like kind of coaching them through the whole thing or being on set and seeing things and being like, "Hey, that's not the way that happened," or "That's not the way law enforcement would respond," or "You need to correct this." And they're like, "Oh yeah, we do." It was very empowering. And I think it wasn't that hard for them to do these things either. I think that's the part that scares a lot of these bigger media companies is they're like, "Oh, this is just the way things are done. And if we involve the survivor, then we can't do what we want." And realistically, my production company, they were thrown a gigantic wrench when one of the other families that was involved with, you know, my serial killer, my captor, said that they did not want their information in the documentary. And I was terrified. How do I take this information to my crew and say, "You can't have this in there"? And they were like, "No problem, we'll figure it out." And they did. It was a learning experience for me. And I just really encourage people that it is difficult, but it's not impossible to do the things that we are encouraging people to do. And we have also had to navigate these tricky situations.
I don't know about you, but I am feeling extra stressed and I would like to not cut my bangs this time. So how are you currently dealing with your stress?
When I realized that I was going to be reliving my trauma on a very frequent basis, I realized that maybe I needed something to increase my stress resiliency. I was lucky enough to find Cured Nutrition. I unequivocally can say it's changed my life and how I deal with stress. I know that sounds dramatic, but Cured is a brand that is high quality. They are full of CBD, adaptogens, and functional mushrooms. All three of those go into your nervous system and they actually calm your nervous system. So you feel a little bit more like a freight liner in the ocean, not getting rocked by the waves, as opposed to a rowboat getting thrown all over the place. And my favorite, Kim got to try when she was here in South Carolina, are the gummies.
I loved it. And I didn't expect them to taste so good.
They're my favorite for when you're feeling a little extra stress on top of your day. Cured Serenity Gummies have CBD, just like all of the Cured products, but they also have ashwagandha and L-theanine. Together, those three go into your system and they just give you a nice, tranquil feeling.
I'm so excited to learn more about them and try more of their products now that you've got me hooked.
Yes. And for any of our listeners who would like to try Cured, you can go to curednutrition.com. That's C-U-R-E-D, nutrition.com. And you can use code KARA10 to get 10% off your purchase today. That's KARA10, curednutrition.com. Give them a try and let us know what you think.
You've talked about like your experience with the documentary and the movie and what it was like on, you know, the back end of it, producing it and having it come out. But did you guys ever consume true crime prior to becoming survivors? And if so, how did it change the way you view it?
So I did not really consume true crime. True crime wasn't necessarily a genre. This was 2002. I was 15. So it was not something that I was consuming. And I would say I still do not consume that. Having lived it, having survived it, having worked it, and then also just being absolutely saturated with it in what I do now, it's definitely not something I consume.
I don't think that I necessarily consumed true crime. Very shortly after my victimization, I became a certified victim advocate and started working at the police department and then worked at the DA's office. And so I didn't need true crime. I was legitimately working cases, much like Kara was. And I don't want to speak for everyone in the criminal justice system, but the majority of them are not going to consume true crime because you're going to see it every day. I will review or watch things that I have been directly involved in or my husband has. And I talked about this for Kara's documentary. We got to watch it live and I was texting back and forth with her the whole time. And I felt like that was one of the very first times that I was able to sit and, air quotes here, enjoy or consume legitimately as a viewer, knowing that she had touched every single piece and had okayed it. And the impact that it had, it was just like, oh my gosh, it was so good. But it was because I knew that it was her stamp of approval on it. Same thing with the movie when we watched it, and we talked about this a little bit on our podcast as well. But knowing that she had an active role in it changes it for survivors like me, at least. And I would assume probably for a lot of people, but on the whole, nope, not a fan.
So just kind of talking about that true crime consumption, it brings up the question of purpose behind it, right? For example, Kim and Kara getting the chance to tell their stories and empower themselves through it, as opposed to it being hijacked and others just using it for example, political gain. One of the questions I have would be, you know, in telling your story in documentary format versus a full-length feature film, is there a difference, or what were some of the differences that you experienced, you know, format-wise and I guess just overall? You gave some really great examples, but were there any other experiences, you know, whether it be emotionally or just overall experience-wise between those two different formats that you experienced?
Yeah, I think for me, the reason I never desired a movie is because I had only ever seen recreations that really just made me go, ooh, like that's the only way I can describe it. And when they would do these recreations, and this is prior to my documentary, when I would tell my story and they would do these recreations, I would be like, that's awful. I hate it. And it would literally make me hate everything about the entire thing that I had worked on. My mind was changed when I did the documentary and I told them, I hate recreations. So you guys have a challenge in front of you. And they did it so, so well. It wasn't this cheesy acting. It was more cinematic and a little artistic the way they shot it. And so it was just illustrative of the story. So whenever the idea came to do a movie, I thought, I know I can trust this team, so I'm willing to take a chance. And what I discovered is it's a little bit like the way my memory works. And I love this illustration that I got from my therapist. She said, you are a visual learner. And she said, if you think about how your memory works, which my memory, when I think back on things, it is like seeing a series of snapshots. It is not like a movie. And so if you think about your mom is telling you about your sixth birthday and she shows you a photograph of your sixth birthday versus your mom is telling you about your birthday and she shows you a video, one of those is going to invoke a lot more emotional connection. And that is the video. So I realized that as long as I had this team that I trusted to do the recreations, as long as I had approval over the script, as long as I was on set, I had approval over all of these things, I could be comfortable with a movie and I would have the ability to reach a different audience because very, very different people consume documentaries and movies. And so my ultimate goal always, the reason I come back to this is to help people feel seen, feel understood. And if I could get my face and my story and my reality in front of more people with a movie that could ultimately feel seen, feel heard, feel understood, then that was it. That was why I was going to do it.
I love that. And we often hear about this idea of learning from true crime cases being discussed on different media platforms. Whether that's awareness of violence against certain communities, the current state of safety and violence and its trends in our country. What are your perspectives as survivors and content creators ourselves now on this idea of learning from true crime and when it's appropriate and when it's not?
I mean, much like what I was just saying with the fact that I was able to watch Kara's documentary and know that she had a hand in it. When you are consuming any kind of content, ask yourself and do some digging. Are these creators getting consent? Is the victim or their family playing an active role? How are they giving back to their community? I think that's a big one that we're seeing a shift in. And I don't know, you guys have been doing this clearly a lot longer than we have, but have you seen a shift in consumer accountability for how people who are making money off of this or growing platforms off of it, giving back? How are you actually impacting and making a difference with the problem itself? It took us forever, first of all, to come up with the name that we wanted for this podcast. I'm not kidding. How long did we throw just the most random stuff back and forth? It was months.
6 months, at least.
Yeah. And we finally landed on this because we had some help from a very dear mutual friend who was saying, you know, it's got to be something that'll hit SEO. It's got to be pretty succinct. And we're finally like, let's do all these words because, you know, our names don't have enough letters in them either. And we landed on Survivor's Guide to True Crime because we're not going to get away from that true crime genre, but we can offer an input or some guides to help those of us that are like us get through it and learn from it. And you don't have to be a survivor to be able to read through and consume a survivor's guide. We are not meant to write this book. We call our episodes chapters because we're sharing that pen, that page, that voice with each of our guests. We want them to lend their experiences and the tools and the things that they've learned to help those who are listening, who are following. But it isn't just us. I think the biggest thing that I take away from true crime is I always look for people who are sharing their platform, not just keeping it for themselves.
To add on to that, I think that when you are consuming these content creators, these podcasts, whatever you're consuming, and it is someone who's doing it ethically, there are things you can learn. I think that there is also this idea that people, women specifically, will consume true crime in the hopes that they will be able to identify someone who might mean them harm, or they might learn something that will help them survive. And to those people, I caution you to really sit down with yourself and think about what is the true reason you are consuming it. Are you saying it is so that you can learn, or are you consuming it because you enjoy it? And if you enjoy it, what does that look like? And I would also advise you to consider that you don't need to learn anything. There was nothing that I was taught. There was nothing that someone said to me that helped me to survive. People often ask me, how did you know to remain calm, to gather information? How did you know to escape? How did you know how to do these things? And to those people, I always say the same thing. It was inside me already. It's inside every single one of you already. We are all born with this amazing protection mechanism that is meant to help us survive. We have a survival system, your fight or flight system. And when you are put in stressful situations, it's your autonomic nervous system. It will automatically choose what is the best option for your survival. And so I say, if you're consuming it to learn, you're never going to understand why bad people do bad things, first of all, if you are a good human. So you can consume all you want. You're never going to figure it out. And you already have it in you to survive. And if you really want to kind of focus more on your safety, I would say the number one thing that you should learn is how to practice situational awareness, which is what Kim and I talk about frequently.
And I think one of the other really cool things too that we're getting as far as feedback, whether it's in our DMs or in reviews or emails, that we have survivors listening who aren't listening to learn how to survive again or something. They're learning that the way that they responded to these abnormal situations was normal. They're feeling validation. And if nothing else, that at the end of the day for us is worth it.
I would love to know both your opinions, what you believe the future of ethics overall in true crime is. And then if you even think it's possible to make truly ethical true crime content.
I think it's going to be driven by consumers, much like any revolution or change, upheaval, if you will. It's driven by the people who are consuming, and it is always follow the money. And if you are not giving your time, talent, and treasure to these people who are not doing it ethically, it will have to change. You can force a hand to do the right thing. It may be long and arduous and tough, but I think the more visibility that we have across all different forms of platforms, the bigger the change will be. Kara and I are not with a network. We chose that as we got started because we didn't want to compromise what we knew needed to be done in the way that it needed to be done. It's tough. Let's be very honest. I don't even want to guess how many hours a week we put into editing and content creation and trying to keep up with DMs and our Patreon and all of those things, but it's us through and through. And we love doing this. It's our passion. We know that it's helping and we're doing it in the right way. And the more people see that and understand that it can still be done, I think we're going to see a huge shift. And I really look forward to that because there's people like you that are willing to learn, that are willing to share your platform, that are looking for ways to improve constantly. Those are the ones that I want to see come out on top. And the only way that we can do that is as consumers to drive that force and to be a voice.
And we have definitely seen consumers begin to be more conscious. We've gotten many messages from people who say, you know, I heard you on this and I heard what you said. And the podcasts that I've been consuming, I asked them, what are they doing to support the communities whose stories they're telling? Did they get permission? And so the more we have these conversations, the more people will realize that maybe this thing that they're doing is harming somebody. And at the end of the day, no one willingly goes into true crime consumption saying, oh, I want to consume this. And I don't care if it's hurting someone. Most of the people who are consuming the content have gigantic hearts and they are consuming it because they want to be safer. They want to understand. And so once they realize that the consumption of these problematic sources could be harmful to someone else, I say, absolutely, it'll change.
Well, and it's not to shame either. I think that's a big piece of this. If you have found yourself watching something that now you know was not created in the correct way, or if you were listening to something and you loved it and then, oh man, that now that I know this feels like that's okay. It's okay. We can all learn. We can all do better. We're not going to hold that against you. We can't do that. That's the only way that people are going to learn is if they feel safe. And if you recognize the ways in which you can change or do better.
So we've touched on this, you know, with that aspect of like looking towards, you know, the true crime content. Is the family involved? Are they at least attempting to get them involved? But what are some of the other cues that you might look for or encourage people who consume true crime to look to? And what's been being done in that respect and what can be better with it?
The very surface level things that I think of is that survivor involved or their family. We obviously know tags on any kind of social media. Point back to them because they probably have information there and people want to see those stories. Tag them. Your show notes, your trigger warnings, your captions, all of that should always have resources and places for them to go so that you are not just leaving them with, here you go, enjoy your trauma, next episode. So you've got to have those places where they can still learn more to do better. And obviously the giving back to the community piece is huge, but are they treating victims with respect? It's so small, but it is a huge philosophy. What you're putting out should never hurt. It should help.
One of the things I love seeing too is when content creators who have these gigantic platforms, they activate those people who are consuming their content to do something with their time, with their money, with their energy. I think if you're doing this and you're doing it for the clout, you're doing it because it's your career, I mean, more power to you. But if you have gotten this gigantic platform and you're giving back to causes that help heal people, there's one podcast network that I know of that we personally have seen give gigantic funds to nonprofits that are helping create survivors out of victims, that are helping heal people. Those are kind of some of the big benchmarks. And I'll add a slight nuance to what Kim said, which is, we're always learning, right? So in that, I've always said, make sure the family is involved, make sure you have their consent, tag back to them. But sometimes they don't want to be tagged they may not want to be involved, but they will say, you know, I'm okay with you covering it. These are the things that I wish to get put across, but please don't tag me. So really just being in, having your finger on that pulse of what is important to that person. Because at the end of the day, just like most people consuming true crime are not doing it with the intent of hurting people, I genuinely believe the best in most people. I think that when we know better, we do better. And I think most content creators are not creating this content to hurt people. So if we can provide these tips and tricks, then I think people will begin to do better.
As I am editing, I do a ton of work on the back end. So there'll be pieces that maybe somebody was talking about and it's in a conversational manner, because when we actually interview these survivors, it is a very at ease, normal flowing conversation where we used to craft questions and send them to them. And we're like, we don't even need to anymore because we're going to talk about wherever you want to steer this. For instance, I have one that I'm in the middle of editing right now, and the guest references a different case that they still had an emotional tie to and it impacted them, but they were not the primary victim. So I took that sound clip, and it doesn't even have their names. And I took that sound clip and said, hey, this is going to be included in this episode. You get to decide, is this represented okay? Does this sound all right? And if you don't like it, I'm going to take it out. And the overwhelming gratitude that came from just doing that one little extra step makes a whole huge world of difference. And yeah, it's more work, but I mean, that's the part that comes out for Kara and I is like, we worked in victim advocacy. We know that if you say you're going to do something, you do it. You get permission every time. I mean, I think about my SANE nurse, the very first morning that I am ever a victim, and all the things that she did right, which boils down to 3 points. She told me what she was going to do. She told me why she was going to do it. And most importantly, she asked my permission. If you can operate around those principles all the time with how you're creating these things, it's going to make a huge difference to survivors like us.
And I would say if you are someone who is out there and you are creating this content and you say, that's too much work, I don't want to do that, then you better freaking stop.
Yeah.
Because we have definitely had scenarios where it comes down to the wire and someone changes their mind about something and they want to pull something. And to be quite honest, it's a gigantic pain in the butt.
Mm-hmm.
However, we are practicing what we preach. Like, oh, well, we will do it ethically. We will put ourselves out there. And if you're not committed to doing that, then maybe you should not be creating true crime content. I'm sorry. Maybe you shouldn't be telling stories of the worst days of people's lives if you can't do it ethically.
I promise you, the extra step that you have to go out of your way for to help a victim is nothing compared to the work and the way that we have had to go out of our way to alter our entire life around this trauma. So you well better be taking those extra steps, because Lord knows we sure have.
I would say if you are someone who is creating content and you run up against these situations where you don't know how to handle them, reach out to someone like myself, someone like Kim, because I have consulted with podcast networks who have come up against situations where they're like, we don't know how to handle this. What should we do ethically? Mm-hmm. We're available. And there are other people who are available. There are whole companies that consult for this kind of thing. So there are resources out there for you. Just know that it's not impossible. You can do it.
We love it. Frankly, I love helping behind the scenes. It's not my story, but I can work with a victim or with the producers to make sure that it is a victim-centric production. Like, oh my gosh, that is one of my favorite things to do. Don't be scared to reach out and ask about these things, because we will be willing to help. And if we're not, we can pass you along to somebody who is.
Well, that means a lot to hear. So thank you.
As we move towards a bit of a closing today, I want to ask each of you if you are willing to give us 3 words that describe what it's like to be a survivor.
The 3 words that I would use to describe being a survivor, always my choice. It's always my choice. I don't wake up every single day feeling like a survivor. There are days that I feel like a victim still. There are moments that I may still feel like a victim. But I wake up and choose to live my life as a survivor. And in that, I want you to understand that you can too.
Mine that I always seem to fall back on, my motto and what everything seems to circle back around to for me is refined and not defined. So refined, not defined. Because I think so often, especially for those of us who are sharing our story publicly, we can get pigeonholed into this one-dimensional character. And for those of you who have just been through something difficult, just remember that the bad things that happen to you in your life absolutely do not define you. Just like Kim said, it is your choice what you take from every situation in your entire life. You get to choose if you pick up offense, if you are refined or defined, if it makes you stronger. I'm not saying it's easy, but I am saying it's possible. And bad things that happen to you don't have to define you.
I absolutely love both of those. Thank you for sharing. I know it can be a vulnerable question, but wow, that was absolutely beautiful from both of you. Thank you.
Thank you. Of course. It's like we do this for a living.
We should start a podcast.
Yeah. Idea.
I'm curious, we've talked a lot about survivors in the public eye, but there are a lot of people who have survivors in their own lives that aren't public with their experiences. So can you touch on, just from your perspective, how best it would be for our listeners to support survivors and their families in their own lives?
I got this one. I feel like I wrote a whole book proposal on this as well.
I feel like you did. Two things. One, I want to bring up, because an important part when you are talking to survivors, always include a call to action. Always look for that. There's got to be a call to action. Just like Kara was saying, you want to activate your listener base. I work with and consult for End Violence Against Women International. It's in its 20th year as a nonprofit that does primarily trainings for first responders, law enforcement, survivors, SANE nurses, victim advocates, like you name it. And they have started a campaign that is now in its 12th year called the Start By Believing campaign. And it's three words, but it is an entire philosophy. And if you are looking for ways to best support survivors in your life, you can access startbybelieving.org. You can go on there and take the pledge that when somebody speaks out to you or discloses abuse, you can say that you will start by believing them. It's study after study after study has shown that when a victim outcries, it's usually to two or three different people that are in their close circle before they will reach out for crisis services or to report, and how they are responded to with those outcries, it shapes the trajectory of their healing journey completely. Because if they are met with belief, they are far more likely to report that crime or to seek crisis services, which ultimately makes our community safer by holding those offenders accountable. If you want to make a difference in your life, that is the best way to do it. Start By Believing has a ton of resources. They are completely free, all online, points you to a bunch of different places. So it's startbybelieving.org. And I would really encourage you to go on there. If you fill out the pledge, you can use our hashtag. It's SGTC, which is Survivor's Guide to True Crime, when you're filling out campaign hashtag, but it's completely free. Go on there, take that pledge. We love to see posts and things with people that are talking about it, but we did just celebrate Start By Believing Day during the month of April. It's always the first Wednesday, and I absolutely love it.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I would say if you are seeking to support the people that are in your life, absolutely start by believing. It's not always necessary to say those exact words. You can do that with intention, with feeling. But also, I think it's so, so important to do a few other things. And this is the basis of what I give my keynotes to law enforcement on. And it's to let the victim or the person in your life that you're trying to support, let them lead the way. Let them tell you what it is that feels right to them. Let them make decisions. Let them have control, because kind of the crux of being a victim is that your control, your choice was taken from you. So never underestimate the power of allowing people to choose, whether that's, I know Kim tells a story where her parents asked her what she wanted for dinner that night. And it's something that is so simple, but is so impactful to begin to make decisions.
Both of your responses are going to be so helpful to our listeners. And I know that going forward, they're going to definitely implement this information. So thank you.
We want to thank both Kim and Kara for joining us today, for your valuable voices. Thank you so much. Please let our listeners know where they can hear more from you.
You can find us at survivorsguidetotruecrime.com. We've got everything listed there. But of course, we are very active on social media. It's SGTC Pod and Survivor's Guide to True Crime, depending on which platform you're on, and we can send some links along. You can always find Kara and I as well, and our stuff is always linked in there.
Yeah, so on all social media platforms, I am Kara Robinson Chamberlain, and Kim is Kimberly Corbin. You can find us, as she said, we're both pretty active on social media. We both also have websites where you can access all of our links. They're just our names, KaraRobinsonChamberlain.com and KimberlyCorbin.com. So if you forget anything else, you can head to any of those websites and you can be linked to all of the things, including resources and all the things we talk about.
That's it for today. Until next time,
stay safe.
Bye.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain. If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show.
To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com.
Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.
Lonely, I'm so lonely, I won't be quitting my day job.